we have had now a look at the operative system engineering and maybe
how flexibility could factor
into
designs.
And our next speaker is Kent Palmer. Now Kent is definitely one of our career birds. He actually holds two PhDs, so must really like that educational process. And he has his most recent PhD is in systems engineering out of Southern Australia, but his PhD is in sociology. So he's he's using both sides of the brain, which not all of us can claim. And today he's going to talk to us about languages?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm clicking the wrong thing.
There you go.
There we go.
Okay, you join me in.
Okay, so basically this is the first talk I've given since I got my PhD, and so I'm going to try to give you some context for the research and that I did and the research that I'm trying to go on to having finished that. So basically the context for this talk is that I started out studying software design methods, real-time software design methods, before UML existed, and when there was a plethora of them. And basically what I was trying to do is figure out what is the field of software design methods. And what's the unity of that field? And so I wrote a paper about that, and it got included in George Clear's journal on systems theory, because I was applying his theory to software design, and so I did that. And what happened was that somebody at NCOSI ran into my work, and I was invited to come give a talk at NCOSI. I didn't attend the conference. I just came in and gave a talk, because one of the things I was considering are what are the foundations of software design. And so basically what happened was that eventually I became a systems engineer, and I got really interested in this topic of systems engineering foundations, because, you know, we're starting to go into academia now, and if we don't have some foundations to build on, then we're going to have a hard time grounding our body of knowledge. And so I decided to do my PhD on that subject, and I made some progress on that, and then my advisor said, well, you ought to apply it to a practical area, which is design. And so I proceeded to change my course and did my dissertation on, it's called Emergent Design. And so then what happened was that when I finished, I decided I'm going to go back and revisit what I did in software and bring it up to the systems level, because I had created these domain-specific languages for architectural design of real-time systems. And so, you know, this was before UML existed. And so I thought, well, now that I've learned something about it, I should go back and fix those up. So my paper is about what changes I would make to the original work that I had done, I guess in 1994 timeframe. So I'm going to rush through this. The slides will be up on the internet so you can see the full set of slides. There's a lot of slides there because I tried to kind of exhaustively cover the subject, but I'm not going to go into all of those slides. I'm just going to kind of give you an overview and I decided to put everything on the first slide. So, so my problematic is what is the foundations of systems engineering? And one of my concerns is that systems engineers don't know much about systems theory. And when you look at the courses that we're teaching at the master's level, we don't teach systems theory. So there's a whole century of material there in academia that could be the foundation for what we're doing, but most systems engineers know nothing about it at all. And so, but then Len Troncalli's here, and he's from the International Society of System Science. And so there is some interest in finding out about the history of systems theory. And I think that's a good thing. So, but what I did was, I was looking at, I wanted to find out what, here's the key question. Is there something about systems engineering that is different than what you would normally have in a discipline? Like, there's all these disciplines, like software has systems and hardware has systems, and there's all these other disciplines in academia that has systems. So what is the unique thing about systems engineering that that it brings to systems theory? Because if we don't bring some unique thing, we're not going to get any leverage within academia. So so I started studying the subject, and I realized that something that hadn't been done before was to ask the question, what is the next level up from systems theory? And so I asked that question, and I came up with the answer that there's, you know, systems theory is an abstraction. You have all these disciplines with systems that they are describing in nature or artificial systems that we're creating. And the next level up is to come up with a general theory of systems. And so then the question is, well, what's the next level up that includes many different things like a system at the same level of abstraction, right? And so I started looking at the literature, and I couldn't find anything. So I decided to create something called schemas theory. And so the next level up I call schemas theory. And it's based on a work by Umberto Eco called Kant and the Platypus. And in that book, he describes the whole history of schemas in the Western tradition. And he, at one point, distinguishes what he calls mathematical and geometrical schemas. And so when I say the word schema, I don't mean all the possible schemas, like the artificial intelligence schemas, and, you know, there's all kinds of schemas, uses of that word, just like the words that we were seeing before, flexibility and so forth. There's all kinds of meanings of this word. So, but I mean a very specific thing, which is these mathematical and geometrical schemas. Basically, they're the schemas projected on space-time. So, so what schemas are composed of is things like a system, but different, okay? So it turns out in the Western tradition, we've explored a whole bunch of things like that. And the first schema that we produced that was basically up until the beginning of the last century was form. Form was it. Our whole tradition was based on form. And basically what happened in the 20th century was that we went away from form in two directions, up and down. We basically went up to systems, and we went down to structures or patterns, right? And so people started studying systems and patterns in nature, and that became the basis of science, was to go from the level of form schema on either side of it, the two adjacent schemas. But I wanted to ask the question, what are the all the schemas. If I'm going to have a general schemas theory, I need a hypothesis about what are all the possible schemas. And where my inspiration came from is that I used to have a lot of email lists and as an administrator, and I'd listen to the discussion of various people from different disciplines on those email lists. And what I noticed was that they'd have arguments over things, and when I looked at what they were arguing about, it was basically they were looking at the same phenomena from different schematic levels. And so, and that caused all kinds of terminological confusion, because they'd be talking about the same phenomena, but one person would be talking at it at the form level, another person would be talking about it at the system level, another person would talk about patterns, and so they wouldn't, they'd talk past each other. So that gave me the idea that we ought to go back into the tradition, and just like we saw systems in the tradition, we ought to go back and look at what are the other schemas that are there in the tradition. And so I did a survey of the tradition, and I came up with the fact that there's 10 schemas that we use in our tradition. And so so I identified my hypothesis, which was that there were these 10 schemas, and I'll just say what they are so you get an idea. The lowest one is a facet, that's like a quark, and then you've got a facet, and then a monad, and then a pattern, and then a form, and then a system, and then something I call a metasystem, and then a domain, a world, a cosmos, and pluriverse. So each of these schemas is a different scope. But the difference between them is that they organize the spatio-temporal world differently. And so that's the key to the thing, is that if you're looking at patterns, the space and time is seen in one way, but if you come up to a form level, space and time is seen in another way. And so these patterns, these schemas nest, and one of the things I did in my research was to try kind of thought experiments to try to see, because I wanted a set of schemas that had no gaps in it. And so basically I did a lot of kind of phenomenological research and looked in the literature as well to make sure that there were no gaps between my hypothetical set of schemas. And it's very important to have a hypothesis about the schemas so that we can then test it. And so that's why I came up with this hypothesis. But the hypothesis has another part of it, which is the connection to dimensionality. And so my hypothesis was that there's two schemas per dimension and two dimensions per schema. And so the schemas are actually connected to a fundamental mathematical thing, dimensions. And so that led me to a whole nother set of research into math, trying to understand the relationship of these schemas to dimensions. And so you get things like the fact that, we have string theory. And before string theory, we thought of monads. You know, monads can be, atoms or fundamental particles or quarks. You know, whatever the lowest thing is that we can imagine and isolate, that's a monad. But we always considered monads as points, right? But string theory considers them as strings, you know, one-dimensional. And it turns out that the monad has this possibility of being either a point or a string. It's either zero-dimensional or one-dimensional. So each one is like that. You know, each schema has two dimensions that it functions in. And one of the things in my research was try to find examples where that wasn't true. And I think I convinced myself that that was true. So anyway, that's schemas theory, right? And then the next thing is that given schemas theory, here's the other thing, this is why it's important, is that we call ourselves systems engineers, but I think we're really schemas engineers. In other words, we're not just dealing with systems, we're dealing with all of these schemas all the time. And what we're not recognizing by calling ourselves systems engineers is that we're dealing with forms, we're dealing with patterns, we're dealing with domains, we're dealing with all of these different schemas, and we're like blind to the other ones because we just consider the system, right? And so that's why it's foundational work. You know, I mean, if I had my way, I would call this schemas engineering. And I'd say when I go to look at a system, I would look for all the different schemas that we're dealing with, and we're dealing with a lot of different schemas. And, you know, one of the things I'd like to do is analyze, you know, projects and things like that and find out if there's any schemas out there that are not in my hypothesis. So anyway, that's something for the future. So given schemas theory as a foundation for systems engineering, and the other thing that's interesting is I went through the literature of art criticism and architecture looking for schemas theory, and they haven't come up with it. It's not in the tradition as far as I can see. And so here's this very interesting point. If we need something deeper than systems, like schemas, as our foundation, then we are bringing something new to academia because it's not there in the tradition. And so the thing is that when we bring that new thing to academia, that means all the other disciplines, they start moving around in relationship to this new thing that we're bringing as our foundation. Because in academia, they're not looking at schemas either. There's no discipline that looks at schemas. And so we have general systems theory, but we don't have general forms theory. We don't have general patterns theory. I had to search and search for a mathematician who had a mathematics of pattern. But I found one eventually, but they're just not studying that. And so what I think is that systems engineering has to bring something new to academia in order to get recognized. And one thing that we can bring is a deeper understanding of the way these schemas operate. And so I think that's another key reason that we need these. Now, what I want to say is that given the fact that we're using schemas to organize our systems and our forms and our patterns, all the stuff that we're building that occupies space-time, the question is, well, how does that affect design? And, you know, I struggled with this problem for a long time. And what I realized was something very interesting, which was that in our tradition, we have the idea of dialectics, right? So there's levels. There's monolectics, you know, which is basically uncritical dogmatic philosophy. And then there's dialectics, which were introduced by Kant in a static form, and then Hegel made it into a dynamic form. And then when I was reading Phenomenology of Mind, I realized that Hegel actually also developed trialectics, right? But if you look at all of the books on dialectics, it's not recognized that he did that. But when he gets to the point of just transitioning to pure spirit, when he's defining work, he defines it in a trialectical way. In other words, it's mediated. Instead of just being thesis, antithesis, synthesis, there's three elements there, right? And I didn't realize that until I read that book myself, finally. And so basically what I've done in order to try to understand what design was to look at extending this to quadrilectics and pentalectics, okay? And so just taking the exact same form that Hegel started with, which gives dynamism to work, extending that. And then I discovered something really interesting, because I had this idea of the structure of the design field. And in my dissertation, I talk about the structure of the design field. Basically, what I do is I take n-dimensional category system, the category theory, which is a kind of mathematics. And it's category theory is all about relationships. And I take that and I extend it on either side to the other schemas. And when you do that, what you find is that these moments of the quadrilectic are embedded in the design field. And so that's a major finding of my work, that the design field itself has a structure to it, which is based on math, but the math has not been fully developed yet. But if you extend the math that exists in n-category theory, you find that these moments of the quadrilectic exist there. And so that's kind of the dynamic aspect of my research, is what are the moments of design and what do they mean? And then the last point is that, coming back to the work that I'd done before, which was creating domain-specific languages for design, I started looking at how can I represent this quadrilectical movement, which is, by the way, based on Buckminster Fuller's work. It's basically taking his work on synergetics, which is about three-dimensional synergies, and applying it to the fourth dimension and looking at fourth-dimensional structures and how they work. So the quadrilectic is basically a four-dimensional dynamic based on quaternions. But anyway, what I did was, after I worked out that structure, I tried to create a language, you know, my little domain-specific language to describe the movement of the quadrilectic. And then that brought me back to my languages, and I had to restructure all of my languages in order to account for this this new information that I had from my research. So anyway, that's the whole story in one slide. And so I don't know how much time I have left, but 5 minutes. Okay, so let me just visit some of these points. You know, like in the work that I did before in software, what I focused on were what are the viewpoints on a real-time system. And I tried to understand, given all the methods that existed at that time, what are the relationships between these viewpoints. And what I discovered was that minimal methods are relationships from one viewpoint to another. So if you're looking at, for instance, data to function or function to data, you've got data flow models or objects. If you're looking one way, you get objects, and you look the other way, you get data flow. And so that's kind of a interesting thing, because in software there's been this paradigm change from functional to object. And then when they created UML, they banned as taboo functional ways of looking. And so when we came to SysML, we had to put function back into it, because at the system level, we can do object-oriented system design, but everyone is used to thinking about it in a functional way, and it was too big a departure to ban functionalities, I think. And so that's why they've put it back in SysML. So what's interesting about that is that this paradigm change that happened in software is just a change in whether you're looking from data to function or function to data. And so, but when you get into real-time systems, you have to start looking at agents and the relationship of agents. And then there are different What's interesting about this is that there's some pathways that are dual pathways and some of them that are two-way pathways. And so you get the interesting thing in real-time systems is that when you don't have a global clock, it becomes relativistic. And so the way this expands into the agent and event is that this is a relativistic field. So this was my original research on design methods, and the whole thing was, see, we have UML, but we don't have a theory of why those minimal methods are represented in UML. Why do we have state machines? Why do we have objects? You know, we have these various things that have been used and put together, but we don't have a theory of the field itself. And so what I tried to do in my original work was develop a theory of the field itself. This is my hypothesis, which I call S prime, of the domains and the idea that there are two dimensions per schema, two schemas per dimension. And the interesting thing, this is the looking at the dimensions in relationship to the schemas. And what's interesting is that we have experience schemas kind of from world down to pattern. And then on either side, there's like scaffolding schemas of the monad and the facet and the cosmos and the pluriverse, which we don't actually experience directly, but we project them as being there. And so there's this really fascinating thing that, you know, the top-level schemas in the ninth dimension, well, the next dimension on is string theory. And the next dimension on from that is called M theory, where Witten had figured out that the different string theories have symmetries and reduced to a single theory in the 11th dimension. But the next dimension on is F theory. And a strange thing happens at F theory, which is that you get two orthogonal timelines. And so they don't know how to handle that. Right. So anyway, but what's interesting about this is if you look at the math and you look at hyperspheres in math, what you see is that when you start with a sphere and then you go up into hyperspheres, they get bigger and bigger up until the fifth dimension and the seventh dimension, and then they start getting smaller and smaller. So it's not how you would think. Higher dimensions are not how you'd think. You'd think it would just be in dimensions keep getting bigger and bigger, but it doesn't. Around the fifth dimension and the seventh dimension, that is as big as you can get. And my hypothesis is that's our design space. We actually think through the schemas about this design space, and that when it starts getting smaller, we just give up. We don't go into those higher levels except in math. We don't have schemas for them. We have mathematical descriptions of them, but we don't have schemas for them. But we need these higher schemas related to dimensions in order to do our design, right? So this is another fundamental thing. We're actually doing multidimensional design. And we always say it's 7 plus or minus 2, but what I'm saying is it's 7 plus or minus 2 dimensions. They're independent elements. And so it's really interesting that the maximal design space is there in these higher dimensions, and we have schemas by which we can understand the structure of those. So anyway, there's a lot of other material in my presentation that, of course, I don't have time to get into, but I hope I gave you the basic idea of my research.